Hi, welcome to Speaking of Sex with the Pleasure Mechanics. I'm Chris from PleasureMechanics.com, and today I have the pleasure of sharing an interview with Lynn Comella, PhD, about the fascinating history of feminist sex toy stores. Before we dive in, I'd like to thank our sponsors for making this podcast possible. Thanks to Cocoon, the new web browser that offers you the safest web browsing experience possible. Shroud yourself in the safety of Cocoon by getting your free download at getcocoon.com/edu. And a very big thank you and welcome to our new sponsor, Good Clean Love. We have been using, loving, and recommending Good Clean Love's organic lubricant for years, and we highly recommend you have a bottle of Good Clean Love on your bedside table. Stay tuned, because later in the show, we're going to share an unbeatable offer from our friends at Good Clean Love. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Lynn Comella, PhD. Lynn is an associate professor of gender and sexuality studies at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. She is an expert on the adult entertainment industry, and her research explores a number of broad sociological themes, including the relationship between sexual politics and consumer culture. Her work has been published everywhere from the International Journal of Communication to Feminist Media Studies to Bitch Magazine and Pacific Standard. Most recently, she is the author of Vibrator Nation: How Feminist Sex Toy Stores Changed the Business of Pleasure. Today, she joins us to explore the history of these retail stores and how they changed the landscape of sex culture. I loved this book for so many reasons, but partly because these stores, like Good Vibrations and Babeland, are how I had my entry into the sex-positive world and the world of sex education. So without Good Vibrations, there would be no Pleasure Mechanics. So it was really great to read the history of them and to understand how these stores and this culture of sex-positive, feminist sex toy stores has changed sex culture for us all. I think you'll find it as fascinating as I did. Let's dive into the interview.
My name's Lynn Comella, and I'm an associate professor of gender and sexuality studies at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I am a full-time academic, researcher, writer, and professor.
And what led you to write Vibrator Nation? Of all topics, why this book?
Right. I've been asked that question a lot since the book came out. And, you know, the story is really kind of simple. I mean, I started this project when I was still in graduate school at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And at that time, I was just really interested in questions of sexual representation and sexual politics, and in particular, kind of public representations of female sexuality. I was really struck by the fact that it seemed like men had a lot of license to be sexual creatures in the world, including in public spaces, where female sexuality was often relegated to the privacy of the home. So I was very interested and started to think about, you know, where are those places where women in particular can kind of step into their sexuality as sexual subjects, not necessarily objects, and really claim, you know, their sexuality for themselves in a way that's public and visible and without shame. And I realized that, you know, hey, there are feminist sex toy shops. I knew of Good Vibrations. I had been to Good Vibrations many years earlier. And it just so happened that at that particular point in time, a feminist sex toy shop had opened in the small college town where I was living, which was Northampton, Massachusetts. And I thought, aha, I'll see if I can interview the store owner and spend some time doing participant observation research in this tiny woman-friendly sex shop. And that's what I did. And my interest in the topic just, you know, snowballed from there. I just was really intrigued by, you know, the ways in which these stores brought together feminist sexual politics and retail culture, how they emphasized sex education in retail spaces, and how they navigated the really slippery slope of identity politics in their merchandising, in their marketing and advertising, and just really kind of the project developed very organically from there. But I didn't start with the idea that I would be writing this book. I honestly started with the idea that I would be writing a paper for a graduate seminar.
All these years later. And what I love about the book is, as much as it's about feminist sex toy stores, it's also about sex culture and tracking the co-evolution of these things. So can you offer us a brief sketch of the history of feminist sex stores and how they influenced and interfaced with our rapidly changing sex culture?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And I'm really glad that that was one of your takeaways from the book. So I'll try to briefly sketch that and, stop me if I'm going on too long. But, the history of feminist sex toy shops really takes us back to the early 1970s. And I think, it's worth people remembering or perhaps realizing that, opportunities for women to engage with their sexuality and publicly shop for sex toy stores is not something that always existed. So the early feminist sex toy stores, Eve's Garden, which was founded in 1974, and Good Vibrations, which opened several years earlier in 1977, were in the 1970s, really stepping into a breach in the sexual marketplace. Because if women wanted to get their hands on vibrators, they would really have to kind of put on a coat of armor in many instances and, work up the courage to go into a conventional adult store that oftentimes wasn't particularly hospitable to them as customers. They might be the only woman in a store filled with men who were looking at pornography and maybe giving them the side eye and wondering what they were doing, trespassing in, this male-oriented space. So, women friendly, feminist-identified sex shops were responding to, a culture where women were not yet recognized as sexual consumers. And yet, at the same time, in the early 1970s, these very same women were being told by feminists, look, vibrators are a tool of sexual liberation. They can really help you explore and discover your bodies and your sexuality in new ways. Get your hands on these fantastic devices. It can be transformative. And women were saying, fantastic, great, I love this idea. Where do I go to get one of these? And that was really the impetus for the initial feminist sex toy stores, was really responding to what their founders, Del Williams, who founded Eve's Garden, and then Joni Blank, who founded Good Vibrations, they were in fact responding to what they saw as a need. They were talking to a lot of women who were just saying, I don't know where I can go to get these, where, I'm not going to be harassed. And so these women just kind of rolled up their sleeves and jumped into the fray. And I think one of the things that I find so interesting about the story of these businesses is they began at a moment in time where there wasn't already an established market. So they were really, kind of carving out a space in the marketplace that really had not been paying any attention to women as potential consumers. So that's a little bit of the brief sketch of those early stores. But to answer the other part of your question, which was about kind of the culture of sex, is that right? You kind of how these stores maybe responded to and also pushed the culture of sex forward in certain ways was, I think that one of the things that I try to make a case for in the book is that, these feminist sex toy shops, so central to their missions was the philosophy of sex positivity. And, this idea that, people deserve pleasure in their lives. They shouldn't be shamed or embarrassed for seeking more pleasure in their lives. Anything goes as long as it's consensual and between adults. And, you know, we want to help kind of spread the good word about sex positivity outward, you know, in the culture. So in many ways, the early feminist sex shop businesses were people's first engagement with ideas of positive sexuality. And then, you know, they came in and had a good experience and went home and told their lovers and friends and family members about this cool little vibrator shop in the San Francisco Mission. And their friends discovered it and went out and told more friends. So it was really this kind of cascading effect of an alternative framework for thinking about, talking about, engaging with sexuality that started to spread out. And I think that that was really boosted in part as businesses like Good Vibrations grew and became kind of a stronger presence in the culture. You had reporters and journalists for women's and men's lifestyle magazines that started to turn to those businesses and call them up on the phone anytime they were writing about sex, sexuality, sex toys, and say, please lend your expert voice to our article. So these, you know, businesses became positioned more and more as sexual experts and go-to businesses for really, kind of smart takes on sexuality, because they were increasingly seen as, you know, having their finger on the pulse of sexuality, of sexual trends. And I think really did help fuel the mainstreaming of sex positivity in certain ways that did have a cultural impact. I think my research shows that, and I hope I'm able to communicate that in the book, that they were, you know, an important portal that many people stepped through in not only their own sexual self-discoveries, but in their own engagement with the message of sex positivity.
Yeah, it feels like generation of sex educators were born out of these stores, and I kind of include myself amongst them. I think if there wasn't a Good Vibrations, there'd be no Pleasure Mechanics, and so many of my peers came out of this world. Can you talk a little bit about how these spaces contributed to the mainstreaming of alternative sexual identities? Because it wasn't just vibrators for straight women they were teaching about, right?
Right. But that took some time, you know. Mm. I mean, there definitely was a focus on vibrators in the 1970s, which has, I think, you know, important kind of historical roots, because a lot of the sex education that feminists were doing in the early 1970s, and I'll include, you know, Betty Dodson and Joni Blank in that as well, was teaching women about their clitorises. So much emphasis on female sexuality had been on women seeking that elusive vaginal orgasm. And a lot of feminists really, you know, pushed back strongly against, you know, Freud's articulation of the vaginal orgasm is the mature female orgasm and the desirable female orgasm. So initially, Eve's Garden and Good Vibrations were very much about vibrators, right? Like, kind of discover your clitoris, vibrators will help you do that. And, you know, it also, I think, should be said that a lot of the early product mix of both Eve's Garden and Good Vibrations was shaped by what the founders thought women wanted, right? Mm. So they were kind of conservative in what they initially offered in the 1970s. And insofar as Good Vibrations go, it really took some of their staff to kind of push Joni Blank forward into a different era of you know, feminist sexual politics, and really make a case, for example, like, you know, women do like the feeling of having things inside them. We should be carrying dildos, especially high quality silicone dildos. What do you say? And Joni Blank, you know, eventually agreed to that. Yeah. Pornography was another hot button issue. Joni Blank initially didn't carry pornography at Good Vibrations because she felt it was a sex store cliche, right? Mm-hmm. And Susie Bright again had to make the case on political and educational terms why pornography could be a really useful vehicle for people's desires and fantasies. But, you know, certainly, you know, beginning to carry dildos and strap-ons. And as these businesses realized, for example, that men were shopping, they had to expand their product mix for people with penises. And then increasingly, their staff was lesbian, bisexual, queer identified, into kink, into, you know, polyamorous, you know, relationships. And so I think the history of these businesses, you know, products are interesting to think about because they were, you know, at times politically contentious and fraught discussions that happened around what these businesses should carry and what kind of statement the products were making. And I talk about that in the book. But it is really the case that as the businesses grew beyond just the vision of their founders, their product mix expanded and their ideas of who was included in the mission really expanded too. And so, you know, they really began to think about, you know, if we're going to be a safe space, as we claim, for people to explore their sexuality, we really need to make a commitment to that and think really broadly and expansively around what types of people and which communities we're catering to, and really, you know, put our money where our mouth is in regard to our mission.
And can you talk a little bit more about how economic class intersects with this idea of who's included? I really loved the chapter about what is gained and lost when we talk about these stores as clean and upscale and classy. That was a really new idea. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, thank you for asking me about that. That was one of the challenging chapters for me to write, probably the most challenging chapter to write, and I'll tell you why. A lot of the people I talked to for this book, and I talked to more than 80 people in terms of doing really in-depth interviews, and then a couple of dozen people more informally, and not surprisingly, it was very easy for people to talk about gender and sexuality in regard to feminist sex toy stores, right? Like, they could talk all day about the ways in which these businesses were gendered and how they saw these businesses working in terms of sex positivity and sexual culture. It was much more difficult for people to articulate the class, this how social class played out in the businesses, and also how race played out in the businesses, right? Like, those were things that I had to kind of tease out. And, you know, it's the case that feminist sex toy stores have historically defined themselves largely by what they're not, right? So, like, we are respectable retailers, we're wholesome retailers, we're classy, we're not crass, we're clean retail spaces, not dirty, dim, sketchy retail places. So I became really interested in trying to tease out the ways in which those discourses of distinction became really foundational for how these businesses saw themselves. And I really saw those types of descriptions as being very class inflected, right? I mean, when you talk about respectability, you're very much talking about people from a certain class background, people from a certain, race or ethnicity. So it was very interesting to think about the ways in which these businesses have gained a certain cultural legitimacy by playing up ideas about respectability. But as I started to tease that out, it became clear that there was an idealized sexual consumer that they were, you know, appealing to. And that was often a kind of white, middle to upper middle class, presumably heterosexual suburban woman. Like, they wanted to make sure that they were an especially inviting store for that subset of female consumers. But often they wouldn't speak directly to that. It was very kind of oblique. It was very coded in this language of, you know, clean, not dirty, respectable, not crass. So they were very much articulating a kind of who they really, really wanted to bring in the store and the ways in which they most certainly did not want to be confused with their more conventional counterparts. That was really, really important. And part of that was because they realized that there was political and commercial value in marking those distinctions. And what I mean by that is they benefited from being able to say, oh, no, don't worry. We are not the stereotypical dirty male-oriented sex shop. We are women-friendly. We're kind of wholesome. And oftentimes that meant that they were able to sidestep restrictive zoning ordinances, or they were able to make a case to a community board that was a little bit nervous about this business becoming part of their business community. They were able to say, oh, no, we're an entirely different kind breed of sex shop. We're a sexuality resource center and boutique. Mm-hmm. And again, when we think about boutique, like, you know, the image of boutique culture is not the same as, say, a Walmart, right? Mm-hmm. It's very, we don't often think of those things as having really strong class connotations, but they actually do, you know?
Yeah. And I think one of the great points you made is some people are more aroused by the dirty, dingy, sticky floor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is interesting to think of, like, how these spaces can be desexualized in a certain way.
Right. And yeah, that is really interesting. And I, you know, talked to a handful of people who said that, you know, they definitely understood what the good vibrations of the world were striving for in their kind of, you know, clean, well-lit retail aesthetic. But they felt that it had been kind of sanitized and desexualized to the point where it wasn't really sexy for them, you know, so they would shop there because they wanted to support the business. And also because that was, you know, one of the places where they could get the products that they most wanted to get. But if they really wanted, you know, a different experience, something a little bit, on the edge, so to speak, they would frequent a different kind of sex shop because it just had a different appeal to them that spoke to, I don't know, what we would call it, a certain risk-taking or salaciousness or walking on the wild side, right? And I definitely talked to those women who said, you know, I can't often buy the products that I want at those more traditional sex shops, but I really enjoy going in there because it feels, you know, like I'm able to tap into a little bit, you know, something a little more salacious than what I'm expected to like.
And I'd like to thank our sponsor, Cocoon, for making this podcast possible. Cocoon is a new web browser, like Firefox or Chrome, that solves three separate problems all in one. It gives you complete security, total privacy, and global accessibility. Recently, we got an email asking for recommendations for porn sites that are safe from malware. You know, those sneaky software bugs that can totally disable your computer. The truth is, there is no site that's totally safe, but the Cocoon browser stops malware from ever reaching your computer. So you can browse wherever you wish for whatever you want with the reassurance that you are shielded by Cocoon. Go to getcocoon.com/edu for your free download. That's getcocoon.com/edu for your free download. And from your new browser, go to goodcleanlove.com and get yourself a bottle of their amazing organic lube. Shop their entire line of wellness products and use the code PLEASURE for 33% off your entire order. That's goodcleanlove.com. Use the code PLEASURE for 33% off your entire order. So we're now at the point where you can buy sex toys on Amazon, you can buy lube in a drugstore. How do you feel about kind of the future of feminist sex stores and where we're going as a culture with the mainstreaming of these products?
Such a good question. And, you know, it's a question that I've been asked a handful of times as I've been touring with the book and talking about the book, kind of what's the future for these businesses. And I think we're at, you know, a really kind of interesting juncture. And it'll be interesting to see what the next, you know, 5 to 10 years holds for these businesses. Because, you know, the sexual marketplace is increasingly competitive. Feminist sex toy shops, you know, for many decades didn't have to contend with online retailers and the internet. That's no longer the case. They are competing with Amazon and drugstore.com and, you know, these other really large retailers. They're trying to figure out pricing. They're trying to figure out, you know, how to remain financially solvent and viable in this increasingly competitive marketplace where they are no longer the only, you know, wholesome, women-friendly, clean and well-lit stores on the block. Because one of the trends that I talk about over the last decade in particular is the extent to which a lot of mainstream retailers who for a long, long time weren't paying that much attention to women, you know, suddenly woke up one day and decided they wanted to learn how to attract women to their businesses. And so they've taken a lot of what Good Vibrations developed, you know, educationally oriented, having a knowledgeable staff, leading with sex education, you know, carrying better quality products, switching up their advertising and marketing. They've adopted, or we could argue co-opted, a lot of those things. And it's definitely made it harder for feminist sex shops. So I think that there will always, hopefully, be a place for the retail experience that feminist retailers provide, that in-store experience of really inviting you into these spaces to engage with your sexuality, to ask questions, to have conversations about sex. I mean, the sexual culture has changed a lot since the early 1970s, but, you know, it is certainly, as you know, not the case that we live in a 100% sex-positive culture by far. Yeah. And it is still very much the case that school-based sex education stinks, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, the retailers that I interviewed continue to work really, really hard to kind of, you know, keep doing what they're doing and to stay financially solvent. And what I will say, and what I've been trying to emphasize as I talk about the book is, you know, if you're listening to this podcast and you're a fan of, you know, Good Vibrations, Babeland, Sugar, Smitten Kitten, Self Serve, Feel More in Oakland, all of these small, almost mom and pop sex toy stores in your local communities, support them. You know, a $15 sale is really not going to make that much difference to Amazon, but it can make the difference for a small, struggling, feminist and queer-friendly sex shop to pay their electric bill. That's real, you know, and it is worth remembering that, you know, there was a time where we had a network of thriving feminist bookstores in this country, and we don't have that anymore, right? So we should never take for granted that these businesses that we love will be here if we can't find ways to support them. And that actually means financially supporting them with our dollars, you know? So I want to kind of emphasize that, because I think we are, you know, at an interesting moment, you know, especially if we think about, you know, the sale of Babeland this summer to Good Vibrations. You know, I certainly didn't see that coming. And I'm someone who has studied this segment of the industry for more than a decade. And I was really surprised. So, you know, I think that a lot of the smaller retailers that I write about, you know, they took note of that. You know, what does that say? That, you know, one of the bigger feminist retailing entities, for whatever reason, felt like it was time to sell. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of people are processing that and trying to figure out, again, you know, what are the things that they can do to make sure that their businesses continue to be relevant, continue to be viable, and that means profitable.
And I also think there's something so amazing, even if you have to travel and take a weekend trip to go to a feminist sex toy store and walk around and touch the products and talk to an educator, it can be a shame-slaying experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it can open up new sexual horizons. And that's an experience you can't really get online.
Oh, yeah, not at all. And I'm so glad you said that. I mean, and that's one of the things that, you know, these businesses really pride themselves on. And that's also why I focused on the stores as opposed to talking, you know, in depth about kind of, you know, online retailing. Because I do believe, you know, there's something to be said about just working up that courage to kind of cross the threshold and walk into a sex toy shop for the first time. And you're confronted with these objects, you know, and today more and more objects, you know, and they're bright and they're colorful and they're wiggly and you can, you know, hold them in your hand and, you know, whatever kind of taboos, you know, or stereotypes people may have had about sex toys, they're often dispelled as they interact with the products and as they walk around the sex shop floor. So I think that experience is something that these retailers are really increasingly emphasizing, although it's always been important. And I like what you said about like take a road trip. You know, if you're 2 hours outside of Albuquerque, hop in your car and go visit self-serve in Albuquerque. It's right on Route 66. It's in an amazing neighborhood. They have a fantastic staff of sex educators. The owner, Mady Fricker, is a delight. Mm-hmm. And they have an antique vibrator museum. Just go to visit and see their collection of antique vibrators. It's a really amazing store that is more than a store. And it's definitely worth going a little bit out of your way to cross that off your bucket list. I mean, there's no way you could possibly be disappointed because it's a really delightful store, as are many of them that I write about.
And we will link up a bunch of options for you all in the show notes page at pleasuremechanics.com. So to finish off, I'm curious, you've been traveling all over the country talking about this book. What has surprised you the most about audience reactions and the questions you're being asked?
Oh, you know, I think it's not necessarily a surprise, but I've just been so delighted by the enthusiastic reception for the book. I mean, really, really delighted. And, you know, I've done events where, you know, I've had aspiring sex educators in the audience who've come with their book already in hand, who've already read it, and they want me to sign it. And, you know, I kind of look at them as I'm talking and, you know, I haven't met them yet, but they're just all smiles and they're nodding their head. And that's just been really cool for me that, you know, people have really kind of jumped into the history and embraced the book and the way that people are connecting with it, right? Like people are connecting with the sex education piece or with the mission piece or, you know, with the tension between feminism and capitalism. And so people are, you know, really getting different things out of the book, but seem very appreciative of the history. And I really like that. And I think the other thing is, you know, I've been talking to a lot of reporters and journalists, and I have to say they've been smart and engaged and have had terrific questions about the book, which, you know, for the most part, they have read cover to cover super closely. Mm-hmm. But some of the best conversations I've had have been with men in their 60s. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have necessarily expected male journalists in their 60s to be not just super enthusiastic about the book and the story it tells, but their ability to get the history has been really so gratifying. And what I realized is that, you know, a lot of these men in their early 60s, they've lived through this. You know, they've witnessed the transformation of the sexual culture. They've, you know, been to Good Vibrations in the 1980s. You know, I did a radio show with someone who in the late 80s interviewed Joni Blank.
Yeah.
And you know, he totally got Joni, got Good Vibrations, got the mission, and could talk so fluently about sex positivity and female sexuality. And I'm like, these businesses have had an impact.
Yeah.
And that might be one of my biggest surprises, to have men in their 60s so fluent in sex positivity and so down with the history, not in a superficial way. Like, they really get it, and they get the importance of these businesses because they've seen the impact that they've made. That's been a treat.
Beautiful. And where can our listeners find you online?
Sure. They can find me on my website, lynncamella.com. And I'm going to try to do more blogging. I've been so busy traveling, but I have information about my academic research and writing and other things on the website. And then on Twitter, I'm at lynncamella. And I also want to make a plug for my Vibrator Nation Instagram account, which I've been having a lot of fun doing. And that's Vibrator_Nation. And I've been trying to post kind of, you know, random things from my own archive that I've collected over the years, you know, feminist sex toy store ads and marketing material and images of antique vibrators and whatnot. So they can follow that account if they're so interested.
Definitely. And check out your book tour dates, because you're going to be touring with a book into the spring.
Yes. So you can find that information about book tour dates on my website. Again, lynncamella.com. There's a tab for tour dates. So indeed, please check that out, because I am crisscrossing the country and it will be going into the spring. So hopefully I'll be in your neck of the woods at some point.
Perfect. And we will link that all up at pleasuremechanics.com. Lynn, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Excellent. So this whole episode has been about the cultural change created by feminist sex stores, and one huge contribution that we didn't mention, that I'm going to mention now, is the mainstreaming of lubricant. It used to be that lube was something they used in the gynecology office to put in a speculum, but the sex-positive sex education movement has taught us that lube makes everything feel more pleasurable. Whether you're doing a hand job or touching the clitoris or having any sort of intercourse, vaginal or anal, a little bit of lube goes a long way to make things slip, slide, and glide in a much more pleasurable way. But you need to be careful about what you put in and on your body. For years, our favorite lube has been the organic lubricant from Good Clean Love. And now we are thrilled to welcome Good Clean Love as a sponsor of this podcast. Their products set the highest standards for body-safe, all-natural ingredients that you can feel good about putting in and on your most sensitive parts. Check out their complete line of pleasure and wellness products at goodcleanlove.com and use the code PLEASURE at checkout for a full 33% off your entire order. We love every drop of Good Clean Love that we've used over the years, and so will you. Go to goodcleanlove.com and use the code PLEASURE for 33% off your order. And we'll be telling you more about some of their fantastic offerings in future episodes. Come on over to pleasuremechanics.com for a complete podcast archive. We always love hearing from you, and we will be back next week with a brand new podcast episode. Until then, I'm Chris from pleasuremechanics.com, wishing you a lifetime of pleasure. Cheers.